Today on Straight Talk Africa, political tensions are rising in the Democratic Republic of Congo. President Joseph Kabila's second and final constitutionally mandated term expired last December, and elections aimed at replacing him are on hold after the Electoral Commission announced this month that it would not be possible to hold elections by the end of the year. Politics in the DRC next on Straight Talk Africa.
Welcome to Straight Talk Africa, live from the Voice of America studios in Washington. I'm Peter Clote in for Shaka Saleh, who is on a special assignment in Africa.
Happy Wednesday, Peter, and hello to all our viewers and listeners on the continent and elsewhere. I'm Ayan Bior, your social media reporter.
Political tensions are simmering in the Democratic Republic of Congo. President Joseph Kabila's final constitutional mandate expired last December, and elections aimed at replacing him have been postponed after the Electoral Commission announced that it will not be possible to hold elections by the end of the year.
And coming up later, our audience has weighed in on our topic through emails, Facebook, and Twitter comments, and we'll reveal some of them ahead on Straight Talk Africa.
Africa is a continent with many aging, long-time leaders. While the Democratic Republic of Congo President Joseph Kabila is only 46 years old, he is a longtime president in his 16th year as the nation's head of state. Straight Talk Africa's Paul Sisko has more on the troubling political times in the DRC.
At number one, Equatorial Guinea's Teodoro Obiang Nguema, 75 years old, has spent more than 38 years as head of state. Angola's José dos Santos, 74, 37 years in power. He's stepping down next Wednesday. Zimbabwe's Robert Mugabe, 93 years young, more than 37 years in power and counting. Cameroon's Paul Biya, 84, in power since 1982. Yoweri Museveni, Uganda, 73 years old and going strong, more than three decades as president. He's into his fifth term. Swaziland's King Maswati, 30 years as Africa's last absolute monarch. He took the throne three decades ago. He was 18 years old. Sudan's Omar al-Bashir, now over 73, with more than 27 years under his belt as the East African nation's leader. The Republic of Congo's Denis Sassou Nguesso, age 73, prime minister from 1979 to 1992, on top of that, 16 years as president and counting. And in the Democratic Republic of Congo, there's Joseph Kabila. President Kabila took over on January 26, 2001, after the assassination of his father, Laurent Kabila. Joseph Kabila's second presidential term expired in December 2016, and he refused to step down. The DRC government and an opposition coalition later agreed to implement a political transition, requiring Kabila to relinquish power after elections that were set for the end of this year. But this month, the nation's election commission said it doesn't have the financial resources to hold an election at the end of 2017 due to a prolonged economic slowdown. Meanwhile, Kabila has kept quiet about his intentions and shown no interest in standing down. Scores of people have died in sporadic protests and demonstrations around the country. Human Rights Watch says at least 27 people, including three police officers, were killed earlier this month in clashes between protesters and Congo police. Several groups in the DRC oppose the Kabila administration. Congo's population has risen to 82.5 million people, growing steadily. The lush, beautiful nation is one of the richest countries in the world in terms of its natural resources. But its history of conflict, poor governance, political instability, lack of infrastructure, corruption, and centuries of both colonial and commercial exploitation has left the DRC one of the poorest nations in the world. Paul Sisko, VOA News, Washington.
Thanks, Paul. Now joining us today in our Washington studio is Dr. Noel Chiani Mwadamvita, a Democratic Republic of Congo presidential candidate. Also joining us live via Skype from Nashville, Tennessee, is Claude Gatebuke, Executive Director of African Great Lakes Action Network. Welcome.
Thanks for having me here.
Thank you, Peter. Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. Now, let me come to you, Dr. Chiani. When you heard the Electoral Commission saying that the elections will not be able to organize this year, logistical challenges, they just can't do it this year. Same thing the government said, they don't have the funds to organize it. What was your reaction as a presidential candidate?
Well, I was not surprised at all when I heard the president of the CENI declaring that the election would not be organized this year, because all along we knew that the regime in Kinshasa, President Kabila and his people, including the CENI, do not want to organize the election, period. President Kabila doesn't want to step down at the end of his mandated term in December 2016. He failed to organize the election. They gave him an extension of 1 year to prepare and organize those elections before December 2017. Again, they are saying that they are not ready to organize, so I do not expect them to be ready anytime soon because they don't have the political will to do so.
Gatebuke, let me come to you. What was your reaction?
My reaction was also, I'm not surprised, because when you look at Kabila, you have to look at how he came to power. Kabila came to power committing war crimes and massacres of Congolese people and Rwandan refugees when Rwanda and Uganda invaded the Congo and first installed his father, and then he replaced his father after the coup in 2001. And what we saw in the UN mapping report is that in certain areas, Kabila, the president, Joseph Kabila, was present when those massacres occurred, and he's been complicit in those massacres, and he has to maintain his presidential immunity in order to evade international justice for the crimes he's committed against the Congolese. But also, in addition to that, he has enriched himself but impoverished the country. Today, the Congolese economy is suffering. The richest country on earth in terms of natural resources is suffering from there's potential famine. They are not paying civil servants who are now threatening to strike. There is high unemployment. The inflation rate is so high that people are going to the black market instead of using the official channels. And there is a major economic crisis. On top of that, the government is has been shown by UN reports that they were involved and complicit in the ethnic massacres that have been taking place over the last year in the Kasai region, a place where 80 mass graves have been found and over a million people have been displaced. So I can't see President Kabila stepping down, although he will be making history as the first Congolese president to step down peacefully, to transfer power peacefully. And I would love to see that for the Congo and for the Congolese people, for their resilience. He has tried everything that he can to squash any amount of dissent. And he's trying to prolong himself into power. And looking around in the region, you look at Uganda, you look at Rwanda, you look at the Republic of Congo. I mean, all of these are presidents for life. They are basically running their personal kingdoms, the countries as personal kingdoms. And he's looking, taking a leaf out of those countries and wanting to do the same.
But Gatebuke, if I may ask you, there was an agreement signed with the Rassemblement to end some of the instability in that part of the country. It was agreed that the president will leave after handing over to his successor if elections are held this year. The agreement basically appears to have been done with because of this concerns that he might want to stay in power. Why didn't the opposition do anything about it, and why are they quiet? Rassemblement basically is saying nothing at the moment.
There are Kabila has succeeded at dividing the opposition because there are a lot of corruption within the opposition where people are either bribed or promoted or given positions, and they are not sticking to the principles. And Kabila has, his terms have expired. They expired in 2016, December 19th, 2016. He's still holding the people hostage today. And although there was an agreement that allows him to stay for the rest of this year and transfer power, he recently mentioned, according to a New York Times article, a recent New York Times article, he recently told a Dutch newspaper that he never promised anything. Now, what's happening in the country, you have four voices now. You got the government, you have the opposition, you have civil society, and now there is a fourth voice, which is the youth. And there has been arbitrary arrest of the youth who are resisting, which is the case, the recent case of Jean-Marie Kalonji, who's the coordinator and the leader of Quatrième Voie, which is fourth voice, the youth voice, and his lawyer. So people are getting arrested even for doing their jobs. The other thing is that the article, the New York Times article, mentions that Kabila once mentioned that Congolese people are cowards, that all you have to do is fire four shots and everybody will run back to their homes, which, of course, I don't believe, because I see a lot of resilience and courage from the Congolese people. But he's making it impossible for the people who are resisting, but they continue to resist nonetheless.
Dr. Chani, let me come to you. Mm-hmm. Some Congolese I spoke with are saying that the opposition has been weak. They are not showing their anger that the agreement brokered by the clergy in the DRC it appears to be violated by the administration in Kinshasa. As a political leader in the country, as a presidential candidate, what did you do in your personal capacity to oppose this?
Yeah, I think that the international community has to understand that the people of the Congo are in a very delicate situation. It is incorrect to say the opposition has not done nothing, just watching the December 31st agreement being violated. As a matter of fact, there have been many demonstrations called by the opposition, and recently, as late as last month, we had what they call Journée Ville Morte, which means those days where people have to stay at home, they don't have to go to work, on instruction from the opposition. And every time that people go on the street to demonstrate, to ask for the right, for the election to be called on, what happened is that the police use excessive force and kill a lot of people. So because of that, we are in a very delicate situation. While the opposition is calling on the population to go on the street, the government, using the security forces, kill these people who are going on the street. So everybody got intimidated. So it is not correct to say that the opposition has not done anything. As a matter of fact, we've been doing a lot. Unfortunately, we are just facing a regime which is badly armed, which has weapon ready to kill almost everybody who is protesting against them. So now, what is the way out? I believe that I'm calling on the international community to realize that the people of the Congo are in very delicate situation. We have to find a way for President Kabila and his regime to organize the election before the end of this year. If that is not the case, there is a way out of this, which will be to organize a transition, but without those who have sabotaged the Constitution, who have also violated the December 31st agreement, which means that President Kabila will have to step aside, leaving other people managing the transition so that those people can plan for the organization of the election within a foreseeable period of time.
Well, we'll come back to your point. Before pausing for a short break, we want to remind you that Straight Talk Africa is now streaming on Facebook. Just enter the keyword Straight Talk Africa and watch our show live. And don't forget to share it with your friends. Also, we are on Twitter and we are tweeting live. Follow us at VOA Shaka. That's VOA Shaka. And join us on today's discussion with your questions and comments.
We are able to touch on the things that are important to people on an everyday basis. We hope that our viewers are getting inspired when they watch our show. They're getting a view of the world from a different perspective, things that perhaps are not in their immediate vicinity. Today, I could put in on the show something that is a little different, a little unique, and this gives me that inspiration to come to work.
Today's youth are not just the next generation of African leaders, they are today's leaders. And this is the time to invest in them, today, not tomorrow. So let's connect, let's engage with each other on issues that will transform our societies.
Innovation, leadership, entrepreneurship, things that you're doing to move the continent forward, to make you the greatest generation that Africa has known.
It's Upfront every Wednesday, 17:30 UTC, right here on The Voice of America.
Welcome back. Before we went on the break, you were talking about what some Congolese are saying, the ineffectiveness of the opposition to challenge what they are seeing as a violation of the peace agreement signed between the government and the Rassemblement. But let me ask you, some Congolese are saying that people in Venezuela are taken to the street irrespective of what was happening, being chased in the street by the state security officers. Congolese are not doing the same. Opposition groups are not doing the same. Some say that you are sitting here in the comfort of Washington, D.C., and you barely come to fight for the people. What do you say to that?
Well, first, let me start by the last portion. I am here in Washington, D.C. because I am a civil servant working for an institution in which Congo is a shareholder. So I believe that I cannot be at the same time in the Congo and at the same time working for the institution that I'm working for now. And by the way, I'm here on my own private capacity. I'm not talking on behalf of the World Bank. So now, as far as those who are in the Congo, they are doing their best. They have called on several demonstrations. The opposition has done its best. Almost every 3 months now, we have calls from the opposition or from civil society organization calling either for Journeville Mort or calling for demonstration on the street. But we have to realize that, no, the government of the Congo is different from the government of Venezuela. In Venezuela, they don't use excessive force to kill people on the street. In the Congo, they have killed tons of people. As a matter of fact, you are aware that recently the UN investigator discovered 80 mass graves. 80 mass graves. Just assume that in every single mass grave you have about 50 people. That's close to 4,000 people killed, which means that we are facing a case where the government of the Congo is unique in the history of the world. It's a government that is killing without any restriction. So I am calling again on the international community to realize that, no, we cannot expect only the people of the Congo without weapon to face a regime which is armed to its death, to its teeth, and which is ready to shoot on everybody who can try to change things. And as a matter of fact, you've heard about 2 weeks ago, there were just small demonstrations. 27 people have been killed. 27, and those are the official figures. We don't know in reality because they kill some people in a remote neighborhood, take those bodies and go and hide them somewhere. So again and again, I'm calling on the international community to realize that the people of the Congo need assistance, need help, need involvement from the international community so that we can change things for the betterness of the world and the peace in the not only in the Congo, in the Great Lake region also.
Claude, let me come to you. I know there has been a call for a general strike, possibly next week. But do you think the criticisms that the opposition groups, including the Rassemblement, has yet to do anything significant to oppose what they have been saying are the attempts by the administration in Kinshasa to undermine the agreement signed last December?
Or anything.
Can you hear me?
Yes, I'm just clarifying as a question, do I think that the opposition has done anything or done enough?
Or do you think the criticisms are justified?
I think some of the criticisms are justified. When you see members of the opposition getting handpicked and joining the government of President Kabila, outside of the agreements that were put in place, for me, I see that as a weakness and an opportunistic move by some of these opposition members. I do think that some of it, I mean, the opposition in the Congo has done a lot more than the opposition does in the region. You look at any country surrounding the Congo. Burundi may be the only country where you had mass demonstrations, which were also put down. But you look at Angola, you look at the Republic of Congo, you look at South Sudan, Uganda, Rwanda, none of those places, you almost cannot demonstrate in those places. And for me, it speaks to, again, the resilience and the courage of the Congolese people. The opposition has, in my opinion, needs to put even more pressure. So what's happening now? If the opposition would follow the lead, or at least what we've heard from the Catholic Church, in that the Catholic Church has declared that it's going to push the people to revolt against the government because the government is not respecting the agreement that they had, that Kabila is not respecting the agreements. And, of course, he's in violation of the Constitution already as of December 19th, 2016. If the opposition will follow that lead and not let up, I think Congo has hope in getting change. However, I'll go back to, again, the beginnings of President Kabila. He is not the type of person that is afraid to kill people in masses. This is what he's done from the first day he set foot in the Congo in 1996 and 1997. And we have seen report after report what he and his allies from Uganda and Rwanda have done. And of course, the region itself, you know, the Congo is probably the most important country on the continent. And the reason I say that is it's the richest country in the world in terms of natural resources. And at the same time, the people are, it's one of the poorest. If they can feed the whole continent. I was looking at a report where it says that not only if the Congo, I think they're producing at a rate of 10% on their arable land. If they use that, they actually could export millions of dollars worth of food supply, and they could feed almost the whole continent. The Congo River could feed, in terms of fish, feed the whole continent. They can electrify, provide electricity to the whole continent. But Kabila has to continue to cripple the country in order to maintain himself in power. On top of that, because of his history, it's to his advantage to do everything that he can and everything in his power to stay and maintain that presidential immunity for as long as possible. And I think the opposition deserves some of the criticism that has been out there, again, because the opposition has been floundering and has been, you know, kind of fractured, divided in terms of how they deal with the agreement. Some of the opposition members are willing to step out of line and go above the agreements, and that renders valid the concerns and the criticism.
Now, Dr. Tiani, let me come to you. The government says a chunk of the stipulations in the agreement have been carried out. A new prime minister was appointed by the president. A host of other things have been done. That, they said, shows the political will that the president has towards the people of Congo. What is your take?
You know, the agreement was very, very clear. It says that the prime minister had to be appointed from the opposition, but that opposition was defined as the Rassemblement. And the Rassemblement itself determined that they were going to present candidates from not only within the Rassemblement, but from the largest political party, which was the UDPS. The current prime minister, Bruno Tshibala, who I know very well, was a long-standing member of the UDPS for many years. But it happens that about 1 month before he was appointed, he was expelled from the opposition. He was expelled from the UDPS and from the Rassemblement. So if President Kabila went to appoint somebody who was expelled from that political grouping, it means simply that that person did not meet the criteria to be the prime minister.
But the opposition accepted it. Rassemblement accepted it.
No, not at all. The Rassemblement never accepted the prime minister. They never accept the prime minister.
But the man is still functioning.
He's functioning because he's imposed by President Kabila and his camp, by the presidential majority. But their opposition do not deal with the prime minister, do not recognize him as the legitimate prime minister representing the country as such. So he was not appointed according to the terms agreed on in the Senko brokered agreement. The second thing is that the head of what it is called the CNCA, which is that body that is supposed to supervise the electoral process, the gentleman is Oleng Ngoy. Oleng Ngoy, again, he was appointed from the portion of the Rassemblement that broke away from the real Rassemblement. So President Kabila and his people did everything to sabotage the system by appointing people who, in reality, they are no longer a member. They are no longer members of the real Rassemblement representing the opposition, but they were member of a small portion that broke away from that original grouping.
Well, but there's division within the ranks of the opposition, so it was taking advantage.
These divisions are financed by the presidential majority. They are created by the presidential majority. They have infiltrated the opposition to create that division within this group so that they can take advantage of the situation by having people who will be loyal to them and not loyal to the opposition. One thing to be that I would like to put on the table here is this. When you look at the composition of the government led by Prime Minister Bruno Tshibala, you find that the key portfolios are in the hand of those people who came from Kabila's side, from the presidential majority, the portfolio of finance, the portfolio of defense, interior. So all the key portfolio continue, the portfolio of media and communication, all those key portfolio continue to be in the hand of President Kabila, as if the opposition has no say whatsoever in this government, even if it is led by Bruno Tshibala. So in reality, Kabila's camp, they don't want to organize the election. They are trying to create the confusion by recruiting among the member of the opposition to just give the impression that, hey, they have a government of national unity, but in reality, they have recruited the people who are no longer loyal to the opposition, who are loyal only to the Kabila's camp.
But you are aware that the Electoral Commission is saying it doesn't have the capacity to organize elections this year. They themselves said it. Briefly, before we go on a break.
You know, in 2006, we had the election. They were organized in a certain way. Congo contributed, the international community contributed. In 2011, we had election at the same time. They knew all along that the election were going to take place in 2016. And the parliament had approved an allocation of $200 million every year to be put aside to finance the election when the election time arrives. Where did this money go? In reality, they did not, did not set aside the resources sufficient enough to finance the organization of the election. They want to use this as an excuse to avoid going to the polls, because they know that if they go to the poll, the government has done such a bad job that they will not be able to survive. I would just like to mention a few of the things that the government has done. Today, the whole country is living in a generalized insecurity. People are being killed almost every day. When you look to the macroeconomic, the economy situation, unemployment rate is just so high. 85% of the active population is unemployed. You find that less than 10% of the population has access to water and electricity and telecommunication services. The mortality rate is just so high. So to make the long story short, this government has done so poorly that they are afraid that if they go to the election, they are going to lose. So they are trying to find excuses in addition to what the gentleman has mentioned, the issue of immunity, what will happen to President Kabila if he's no longer president of the country. The combination of all of that makes them reluctant to organize the election because they want to continue to be there.
Peter, if I can If I can add to this.
We'll come back. We'll come back to you when we take a quick break. You are tuned into Straight Talk Africa. We'll have more of our discussion in a moment, including our social media segment.
The lyrics could be French,
English,
Portuguese,
Bantu,
Arabic.
It is the beat.
The African beat that counts.
The beat does all the translations.
It cuts across all languages and gives us the understanding that this is the African beat.
It is so distinct
and adhesive.
It binds us together.
African beat on the Voice of America. For more information, visit our website at www.voanews.com/African Beat.
Like Voice of America on Facebook. Follow VOA on Twitter. Join VOA on our YouTube channel. Like, follow, join VOA.
Welcome back to Straight Talk Africa, live from Washington. It's time to bring in our social media reporter, Ayen Bureau. Hello, Ayen.
Well, hello again, Peter. As you've mentioned, political tensions are rising in the Democratic Republic of Congo. President Joseph Kabila's final constitutional mandate expired last December, and elections aimed at replacing him are on hold. Well, this leads us to our question of the week, which asked, do you believe that President Joseph Kabila will peacefully relinquish power? Well, before we begin, I'd like to thank all of you for using our social media platforms to communicate with us. And another reminder that we are tweeting live today. Use the hashtag VOADRCTransition. And if you haven't yet, please follow us at VOA Shaka. Speaking of it, let's go to a tweet from Isaac Baha, who tweets, Kabila will never relinquish power. He's graduated from Paul Kagame, Pierre Nkurunziza, and the Dos Santos School of Governance. And we have another tweet from Habat Nkula, who tweets, that's utopia for him to relinquish power peacefully. My anticipation is that he will go if force is applied. Well, now to our comment of the week from Facebook fan Victor Salam Musonda in Lusaka, Zambia, who writes, President Kabila can peacefully relinquish power if it's by the people who gave him the power. But if those people are bootlickers, he will be free to hold on indefinitely. It's not about peaceful transition, but the willingness of the voters. Well, let's go to another comment from Facebook fan Eric Kamru in Mwanza, Tanzania, who writes, the problem is not President Kabila, but the people of Congo and the lack of unity needed to build our country and forget about politics. It's better to use minerals and forest resources effectively. We must be together to solve our problems. We don't have to change our system of leadership. And our last Facebook comment comes from Philip De Ruler in Boston, Massachusetts. He writes, no, I don't think it will be possible for President Kabila to peacefully give up power. The people of Congo are fed up with him. Secondly, it is now common in Africa that the transitions of power are no longer through the ballot box. Sitting governments usually manipulate the results. Well, very interesting round of comments. And now a reminder that we appreciate all of the audience feedback, so please keep them coming. And if you're a new fan, drop us a line at africatv@voanews.com. Once again, our email address is africatv@voanews.com. Or post your comment on our Facebook page. Enter the keywords Straight Talk Africa. Interact with our show as it's streaming live. Be sure to visit us online at voaafrica.com, or you can join our YouTube channel. Sign up to VOA TV to Africa and follow us on Twitter at VOA Shaka. A reminder that the show is streaming live every Wednesday. Go to VOA Straight Talk Africa TV program page on our website, or you can simply watch us live on your mobile device. Just download the VOA mobile app. Now let's take a look at what's on tap for next week's program.
On the next Straight Talk Africa, we'll discuss why ailing African leaders often travel abroad for their medical care. Should this be an acceptable practice? We'll delve into the issue on Straight Talk Africa.
Well, that's all for today's social media segment. Peter, as you could probably tell, a lot of people online are not convinced that Kabila will peacefully give up power. Back to you.
Thank you very much, Ian. Today we are talking about the political tensions in the Democratic Republic of Congo. Our guests are Dr. Noel Chiani Mwadam-Vita, a Democratic Republic of Congo presidential candidate. And joining us on Skype from Nashville, Tennessee, is Claude Gatebuke, Executive Director of African Great Lakes Action Network. Claude, let me come to you. What do you make of the viewer comments?
I agree with most of the comments from the viewers. The skepticism is not just skepticism, but it's the truth. And I like the fact that they brought it a level higher, which is what I wanted to do before we went on break, is to look at both the regional dynamics and the international community. So here we have, for example, the I want to talk about the donor nations and the African Union. Here we have the United States gave $400 million to the DRC in 2015 and $340 million last year, 2016. And of course, this year is not completed yet, so we don't know exactly how much they gave. But where does that money go? Where are they, you know, what, how can they continue to? And the support was never stopped, by the way, when Kabila went past his terms. And now, on top of that, the African Union continues to, it has a policy of, we do not recognize, and this is actually further past, you know, beyond the African Union, we do not recognize any president that take over through coups. But now we see the new trend of not respecting constitutions, that these presidents held the Bible or the Quran and swore to uphold that constitution, and they still go past that like Kabila's doing. Or these presidents go back and change the constitutions that they swore to uphold while they were in office. And the African Union sits there and allows that to happen and does nothing. And still recognizes those presidents. In addition, we've got multiple regions of Africa. We've got ECOWAS in West Africa, which has done well in terms of enforcing democracy, which we have seen in multiple countries, the most recent being the Gambia, where former dictator Yahya Jammeh was trying to hold on and hold on by power. And ECOWAS, as a community, went up there and removed him. We've also seen the Southern African Development Community, SADC, which is one of the most democratic region in the continent, if not the most democratic region in Africa, with a few exceptions. They played a key role in stopping the recent invasion of the DRC. Malawi, Tanzania, and South Africa sent troops to fight back the M23, which was a rebellion sponsored by the government of Rwanda. Now, however, we have not seen not any kind of effort from the African body, the African Union, to really push back on this practice of changing constitutions so that presidents can stay in power forever. Also, from the donor nations, again, I spoke about the U.S. and how much money they give. Gave $400 million, and then Kabila turned around and paid $4 million in lobbying last year in the U.S. to U.S. firms. I'm not sure how much he pays outside of the U.S. for other lobby firms. This is a sign that he's not leaving, and there's still no kind of sanctions, no international sanctions, having found 80 mass graves, recent mass graves. They still put no sanctions in place to any of the other regional leaders. And if you look at Central Africa, Central and East and in the Horn of Africa, the whole middle part of Africa, it's the most undemocratic, the most unstable, and the one that needs help the most. And
But Claude, let me ask you this. Yes. With regards to the mass graves,
yes,
it was not clear
or credible that the government was accused of, or soldiers from the government committed those atrocities. There are a host of armed groups in those regions.
So we've seen, recently, within the last year, the Congolese soldiers shooting standing civilians. This was in Kasai, near the region where these mass graves were found. On video, by the way. I believe it may have been one of the soldiers that was videotaping because it was really up close, and it was gruesome. Now, and we've seen multiple reports in the past where, again, President Kabila cannot be separated from his sponsors and those who brought him to power in Uganda and Rwanda, President Museveni and Kagame.
Claude, I understand where you're coming from. However, empirical proof usually is asked when you accuse the government of the day of committing gross human rights violations like that.
So let's talk about what we've seen on camera, right? The demonstrations prior to the elections, what happened to the people that demonstrated? About 50 people were killed, right? In broad daylight, in front of international media. And so when a government goes out and does things like that, and by the way, they also killed the investigators, the UN investigators that were investigating some of these, the UN expert reporters that were in the Congo. And that is fishy. Yes, let me just bring it down a notch to suspicion. Let's call it suspicion, right? Who has the most power, especially in that region of the country? In the Kasai region has not been one of the occupied regions for the most part in the Congo. It's farther west than the eastern part that's been occupied. So the government has had control of that region for a long time. And by the way, they have never brought anybody to book for those crimes. No one. So how is it that we've got mass graves in a country, in the center of the country, and no one, no suspect has been brought to book, and these crimes are just not being discovered? Does that just not sound really fishy and sounds like the government has a hand in it?
I would like to follow up on this.
I understand that. Yeah, but supporters of the government are saying that allegations of atrocities are always leveled against the government. However, these armed groups usually use guerrilla tactics. They murder people, and nobody talks about that. They said, the government says, that it is carrying out the constitution which mandates them to protect life and property. You doubt that. Why?
Let me say this. Some of these guerrilla groups are themselves maintained by the government. And I will give a very specific example.
You need to provide proof of that.
There is a very well-known guerrilla leader called Gedeon Kyungu, who was held in jail in Katanga. No, he was not in jail, but he turned himself in. Once he turned himself in with his people, he found himself to be in Kasai. Why such a criminal person who is known very well, who is a guerrilla leader, who is a killer, why would you be allowed to go to Kasai to do what? So in reality, this man went on a mission to kill. That's the first thing. But the second thing is, when you are a leader of a country like the Congo, you control the army, the police, the security services. Can we imagine that 4,000 people can be killed and buried in mass graves without the police, the army, or the security services knowing about them? No way. In addition to that, if the army, the police, or the security services knew about them, of course the president of the country should have the security information and should know that his people are being killed, because he's the number one person who should protect these people. And because they were not protected, and because also the truth was being hidden from the media, from the international community, until the UN investigator came to discover what was happening, I believe that the government is the number one suspect in those killings in Kasai.
We'll come back to you when we return from a break. A reminder that you are tuned in to Straight Talk Africa.
Like Voice of America on Facebook. Follow VOA on Twitter. join VOA on our YouTube channel. Like, follow, join VOA.
If you liked today's show, please write and tell us what you think or give us some suggestions. Be sure to tell us what station you're tuned into. Our address, Straight Talk Africa, Voice of America, 330 Independence Avenue Southwest, Washington, D.C., 20237, USA. Or send us an email at africatv@voanews.com. Log on to our website at voaafrica.com. Or post your comments on Facebook, keywords Straight Talk Africa.
Welcome back on Straight Talk Africa. Dr. Chiani, let me come back to you. A report by the International Displacement Monitoring Center says that nearly 1 million people have so far been displaced in the DRC from the beginning of the year. Mm-hmm. Now, several factors have been attributed to that, including the conflict from both the rebels and, you know, the government. Why is this so?
Well, first of all, Kasai is in the center of the Congo. So it's very far from the borders where fighting in the past have taken place. So those people in Kasai are not used to this kind of war. For this kind of activity, the rebel group, to suddenly emerge in Kasai, there must be a reason. One of the main reasons which provoked the rebellion between the local groups and the government forces is the killing of a traditional chief called Kamuina Sapu in the western Kasai province. Once Kamuina Sapu was killed, and we don't understand the reason why the government has this easy hand anytime that there is a conflict between the government and individuals, why can they just go and surround the person, arrest him, take him to court, and try to understand what is happening? Why the government has that habit of easy hand of killing people? If they did not kill Kamuina Sapu, I believe that we will not have as many persons killed as we have today. That's the first thing. But the second thing also, we do believe that there was a reason why the massacre in Kasai were organized. The government is trying to create insecurity throughout the country to justify not organizing the election. They were planning to say, well, the CENI people, the National Electoral Committee, Commission, cannot send the people there, and therefore we cannot organize election in the Kasai province, and because we can't organize the election without two or three provinces of the country, therefore we have to delay the whole process. That was the main justification, and again, that is the justification which makes today that many of the prisons in the Congo are just being, they open the door, they let the prisoner run away, and they claim that there is general insecurity in the country, and therefore, because of that, we will have to delay the organization of the election.
So you think this is just a plot by the government to delay the elections?
Everybody knows it. All the Congolese do believe that the insecurity is created and maintained by the government. And if that is not the case, therefore, the government should just pack its things and go, because they are unable to protect the population and to maintain peace and security.
Well, let me ask you this. Mwanda Nsemi, the self-styled prophet, has released a video saying that on the 21st of August, if there's no insurrection, that he says, an uprising, he and his leaders, followers, will leave the country. Do you subscribe to his assessment of the situation in the DRC?
It's a very delicate. Many Congolese believe that there is some kind of complacency between that group and the presidential majority, trying to create insecurity and show that the election cannot be organized. It's very difficult for me from here to make a sense if that claim is correct or not. But it's very bizarre that Mwana Nsemi, who was held in the Makala prison in Kinshasa, they opened the door, he ran out, somebody who is very well known, and he just disappeared in the nature. And then a few months later, he erupted, threatening the government, walking on the street, giving ultimatum to the government. This is quite very bizarre. Where are the security forces? Where is the police? Where are the army? No, all those, the security services. So those things lead many Congolese to believe that there is some kind of deal between Mwana Semi and President Kabila or the presidential majority to create that kind of insecurity and justify not going to the elections.
Claude, let me come to you. Next week, the opposition is calling for a national strike. Do you think that will hold?
It's good. I didn't catch the last part.
Well, I'm asking if the call for a national strike by the opposition will hold, and how effective do you think that will be?
I think it's important that the opposition does that, and I think that plenty of people are going to partake in it. And the reason I say that is because in the past, we have seen people strike or demonstrate from as far west as Kinshasa to as far east as Goma and multiple places in between. And I think it's again, important that the people in the Congo continue to push for the change, because that also increases the pressure on the sponsors of the government. And it also gives those on the outside who are doing work to push the donor nations and the international community to do right by the Congolese people. It shows that the people are looking for change. I do think personally that the lead for change is really going to come from the youth. And I've been following a lot of what the youth are doing, especially Quatrième Voix, Il Est Temps, Fourth Voice, the Fourth Voice, that, you know, the way they're organizing, in spite of being abducted, and there are many who are now detained, and obviously you may have heard of Jean-Marie Kalonji, who's been abducted twice by the government, and only because of local outrage and international pressure was he released, and this has happened twice. I do see the youth of the Congo as the ones who are going to really lead this change. I also think that the Catholic Church, which is very popular in the Congo, the largest in the Congo, pushing and saying that they are going to ask the people to revolt against the government is key if they follow through with that ask. So I think next week is going to be key. I think it's going to be important. But as usual, anytime there is a strike, Kabila's security forces, you know, go after the people. And so I don't expect that the security forces are going to do their job like they're supposed to, which is to protect the people. I expect that they're going to go after the people instead. And especially after the organizers, the lesser known organizers. And that is a shame for me in terms of, you know, seeing it from the perspective of the international community is a shame. How do we invest so much money in a place? You know, they're receiving military training from the international community. They're receiving funds from the international community. And really all they have gotten is the international community partaking in the plundering of the Congo and in the maintaining of this regime that is deadly to the people in place. And I'll end with a quote from Antonio Gutierrez, who is the head of the UN. In 2008, he said, "The international community has plundered the Congo, and we should not forget that." And it's a shame that, you know, we're doing this, and the international community is doing this, and allowing President Kabila to remain in power because he's facilitating the plundering of the people, the richest country in the world having the poorest people in the world.
Your point is well taken. Dr. Chiani, let me come to you. You proposed an 800 billion Chiani Marshall Plan for the reconstruction of the DRC. How do you think this plan will work in your country?
Yes, in fact, I am proposing a plan which is unconventional. I believe that the problems of the Congo cover almost all the sectors, and they cannot be solved with traditional small cosmetic reforms. For us to address the problem of the Congo, we have to look to what was done, for example, for Western European countries after the World War. Congo is almost in the same situation. The economic fabric of the country has been destroyed. The industrial base has been destroyed. The unemployment is rampant. As I said, 85% of the working, of the active population is unemployed. Every single sector, there is no electricity, no water, no good school. Every single sector is facing development challenges. I am proposing a 15-year development plan that will be implemented in increment of 5 years because the presidential term is for 5 years. That plan will have to address a number of issues. First, in 10 pillars, I mean. First, we are going to put in place a system of good governance, put in place the rule of law, institution which can make the democracy function normally. Without peace and stability, this plan cannot be implemented. So this plan will aim first to put in place the prerequisite to restructure the army, the police, to have a national army which can protect the people. Second, we have to put in place mechanisms for good governance and efficient use of public resources. Today, as I said, Congo is a very rich country. We have about 1,100 different precious metals worth some $38 billion. With that alone, we can finance the implementation of this plan. But 85% of the mining revenues don't go in the national budget. They go in private pocket. So we have to restructure the mechanism of governance so that the money which is generated by the country's wealth can go in the national budget and can be used to finance development.
You are fully aware that agreements have been signed in exchange of some of the minerals, so you don't have that amount of money.
I know. And at the right time, all those agreements will be put on the table. We are going to examine each and every one of them, and we are going to have the revised agreement in the best interest of both the foreign investors, but also the people of the Congo. But the third pillar of the strategy that I'm proposing is to invest in the Congolese people, the Congolese youth, the Congolese men and women. How? Through improvement of the education system and also improvement of the health system and providing what I call food sufficiency to make sure that now we can produce locally enough food to feed our people, but also to export to other countries. Next, we are going to implement a massive, massive infrastructure development program. You know that Congo is big, almost like one-third of the United States, but we have no roads, we have no port, we have no airport. What we have is almost obsolete. We are going to implement this program to build the new highway system, new roads, to be able to connect all the provinces internally, creating a local internal market, but also connect the Congo to surrounding countries. The next pillar of the strategy, which is very important, is called promoting accelerated industrialization of the country.
We might have to come back on that later because it's time for us to go. On that note, thanks to our guest, Dr. Noel K. Chiani Mwademvita, a Democratic Republic of Congo presidential candidate, and Claude Gatebuke, who joined us live via from Nashville, Tennessee, via Skype. Thanks to our affiliate stations, along with our viewers and listeners, we thank you for tuning in. For many of our Voice of America radio affiliates, Learning English is coming up next. And tomorrow morning, it's Daybreak Africa with James Batty. On behalf of the Voice of America, thanks for tuning in to Straight Talk Africa.